Dragon Margin issue, which will be a Dragon Margin source of your show.
So, we found this very interesting concept, which helps us to reflect on what this whole sugya has been about, what this whole idea of this unique concept of pshara, which as we've been discussing, is somewhat of a hybrid of straight din and hechver das, and actual judicial process, and at the same time stands somewhat apart from din, and has this unique attribute of shalom woven into it. A fascinating idea. So, we saw that the Gemara has a limitation. And the Gemara says, more briefly at the top of the Amud, and then goes into it in much more detail, at the bottom of the Amud, the top of Amud Beis, we saw Nigmar Hadin, Iyat HaRashai Lutzoah, that once the din is over, then you cannot decide to all of a sudden make a pshara at that point. Noted in the past that the Gemara goes back and forth between Bitsua and Pshara as words, as ways to refer to what's going on, to this type of extrajudicial settlement. And you mentioned that the Pshara has a nicer connotation to it than Bitsua. And it seems that if you go through the words here, that Bitsua is invoked whenever it's a bad idea, and Pshara is invoked when it's good, and different kinds of directions like that. So here, Nigmar Din, Yatai Rishai Lutzoa, so then it's going to be a Bitsua. You can't do it at that point. So we started to note that there is a significant machlokas rishon about what is going on. That when we talk about there's a certain point when the din is already settled that no longer allows for pshara, so what point are we talking about? So Rashi over here, and the Rambam also, by the way, Rashi and the Rambam both say that you've already told them what's up. You've already said, you're chayiv, you're pater, so now at that point, you can't have a pshara. And when we asked for suggestions yesterday, why should that be? So we saw some good suggestions. It could be that at that point already, you're not dealing with a real give and take about where these things could go once they've already given the situation that one person has won and one person hasn't won. Judah suggested that maybe it's a limitation on the credibility of din. If we're going to say that even once we've already issued the din, now we're still opening it up to change that and to not have that be the actual bottom line, maybe we have problems on that front. But Tosfos, very interestingly, Tosfos differs from this. And Tosfos seems to assume that of course once you've given the Gemara din, once you've issued the ruling, then there's nothing to talk about in terms of pshara. So therefore, if the Gemara has to bother to say it, it must mean something else. And what does it mean? It means that when you're pretty much sure, when they've already decided internally, and they've done everything but say that this is the ruling to the parties, then it's wrong to offer a pshara. Why is it wrong at that stage if they don't even know? So Tosfos basically says, well, that's the problem. They don't know. And therefore, they're being misled. Or they're potentially being misled. Because if the party knew, let's say the victorious party knew, that one more minute, and they're going to tell them that you're the winner, then he would never agree to a pshara. So essentially, he's not being given facts that actually exist. Right? Until before this, it's basically a hypothetical. There's no one in the world who knows what's going to happen with the situation. So if there's nobody who knows, okay, so then it's fair to say, listen, before anyone figures out what's happening here, let's try to deal with this in a different way. But one, somebody knows, even though they don't know. Even though the parties don't know, but the Dayanim know. So then already there's information out there that's being held back, and probably relevant also is being held back by the people doing the talking. Right? The Dayanim themselves know, and they're not sharing that information with the parties. So we have to worry that there is a lack of full disclosure. And for them to commit to Pshara at that point,
there'd be something inappropriate about that. So Tosus's question on Rashi, that there's nothing even to talk about once you've already said you're chayiv and you're pater. So some point out, and in fact Tosus themselves elsewhere point out, that there is a Gemara, which sounds a little differently. So the Gemara happens to be in Bavitzia. Again, this is a Marmok that we could take note of. I should have given you on this list, but you could take note of it and look it up tomorrow. There's a Tosus both in Bavitzia and also in Bava Kamma. And because there's Bava Metzia on my desk, so we'll either post this in Bava Metzia to make reference to, but it's in Bava Kamma, Daf Samach Tes, Amud Aleph, on the top of the page, and it's in Bava Metzia, Yud Zayin, Amud Aleph, on the top of the page. And here, the Gemara in Bava Metzia, again, take a look at it tomorrow, basically states that even once the Dayanim say to the parties, you are Chayiv and you are Pater, that's not really considered a Gemara Din. I think that's pretty Gemari, but no, that's still not a Gemara Din. That you don't have to say, okay, since you are Chayiv and you are Pater, Chayiv man, please give the money to Pater man. So, give the money to Zakai man is really a better way to say it. So, if that's the case, so then the Gemara Din hasn't happened yet. Which really could explain Rashi. Right, as the Aruch Lanier points out over here. Right, that Rashi, you're going to say, well, what's there even Shaykh to talk about if they've already said the story? So the parties already know what's happening. How could you even think there's a concept of Shara? So maybe not. Maybe they know that the Dayan have basically said, okay, abstractly it seems that Reuven is Chayiv and Shimon is Zakai, but until they actually say, okay, therefore we're telling Reuven to give the money to Shimon, maybe they still won't. Maybe there's still room to wonder about how things are going to turn out. Maybe there'll be some kind of technicality. Who knows? So Tosus actually discusses this. So Tosus in Bava Metzia and in Bava Kamma, but I'll have Bava Metzia here, so I'll quote from here. So this Hebrew Maskel Chayev Ota Litemo. So it says Tosus here, Hocha Mashma the Chayev Ota Litemo Lo Havi Psakim Gomer. That if the Beis Din says you are obligated to give to the other guy, that's not called actual psak din. That's not called a full psak din. Ki im say the tema. That you have to actually then say, so go out and give it to him. That's the real commandment. The chemashim ruba, but the kamasam testament out the page that we say. So that's what it sounds like from those two gemaras. So vakasha the parakama the Sanhedrin. So in our Gemara, we talk about Hechi Dami Gemar Din Ploni Ata Chayev Ploni Ata Zakai. The Yishlomar the Hasam Mikri Gemar Din LeInyan SheAsu LeTzol LeFishi Odeya LeHechan HaDinot. So essentially, Tosa says that for the purposes of our halacha that we're talking about, it's considered to be a Gemar Din because the Dayanim then essentially know what's happening. Right? That once the Dayanim are on the cusp of saying it, that's what's relevant for the purposes of prohibiting pshar. So basically, you could have asked against Tosfos that Rashi makes sense because of this distinction. So this Tosfos is basically telling you what our Tosfos is thinking, that even though that distinction is there, it's not relevant for pshar purposes. And if you look at the Yad Ramah, it's a good mar welcome to add also, the Yad Ramah on our daf. The Yad Ramah says that he raises the question that here the Gemara in Bava Metzia suggests that the story is not over until they actually say, go out and pay it. And in our Gemara, it sounds like it's over as soon as you say, you're Chayiv and you're Zakai. So it says, Tos says the Yad Ramah, very fascinating, that this Gemara in Bava Metzia is interested in what the Bali didn't think. Because the Gemara, if you want to take a look at it, the Gemara is talking about the credibility of a person when he says that he followed the Pesach of Beis Din. So if he wants to claim that he paid a debt after Beis Din instructed him to, so when is he considered to be instructed? Once they say, you are Chayiv and you are Zakai, or only after they actually say, so get up and do something about it? So there, in this context, in Bava Metzia, says the Yad Ramah, we're interested in what the Bali Din thinks. The Bali Din thinks it's not over until it's mamish over. But in Sanhedrin, we're interested in what the Dayanim think. Right, which essentially is along the lines of Tosfos, that it's not just about they know what the story is, like Rashi maybe sounded like, and therefore you can't have a pshara when they know and they have been told. But the issue is that once the Dayanim know, so then apparently we're worried that you can't actually have a pshara under those circumstances. Yes?
So isn't there a contradiction in Tosfos, Tosfos and Gemara, Sanhedrin, assume that there's not even such a thing as pshara? It doesn't make any sense once Gemara happens. Rashi's definition of Gemara, and the Tosfos over there assumes that there is such a thing as pshara, just told not to.
Yeah, so that's essentially what the Aruch Haner is, that the Tosfos here is at odds with Tosfos there, but one could just kind of rejigger it a little bit and make the Tosfos here. You're going to have to change it a little bit because Tosfos is saying that Rashi is a problem, but you can use this Tosfos to flesh out their position. Basically say that Rashi is focusing on the issue of once the Bali didn't know, there's no turning back. And Tosfos is still focusing on the Dayanim, that the Dayanim know, and therefore they are misleading the public. And within that, one can say that, no, that this distinction is relevant, that once the Dayanim know where it's going to go, and they've already said, okay, even if they've already said, Atachai Batazakai, still the Bali Din don't know. Right? Because still, they might think things might change, and therefore, really, it's also still relevant to understanding the Das of the Dayanim specifically. So what's interesting, though, is that, practically speaking, we make a distinction between reaching that actual final point, even if it's before they've been told, and a stage very close to that, which the Gemara calls Kishata Yodea Lehechan Hadin Nota. Right? Let's say when you reach the stage where you have a pretty good sense of where things are headed. So if you look later on in the Daf, in Vav Amud Beis, where the Gemara fleshes out this issue a little bit more, right? So the Gemara says that it's appropriate to suggest Pshara at the beginning, right? So the top of the, say, the first medium-sized line of Vav Amud Beis, so Rav Shimon ben Asi Omer, Shnayim Shabal Lefanecha Lagu, let's say two people come to you for din, if you haven't heard what they have to say yet at all, you have heard a little bit, but you still haven't heard enough to know who has got the likelihood on their side. So then, then you can tell them, listen, let's deal with this as a pshat. Mishatishma divrehen. When you have heard what they had to say, and you know where things are going, right, then you can't say, go out and deal with the pshara, shenamar, poter, mayim, rishis, madom, lefnei, hiskal, hariv, netosh. So that pasuk, which means that machlokas gets very bad at the beginning, and therefore you should abandon it before it turns out into a real fight. Lefnei hiskala hariv netosh, abandon it before it becomes a real fight. So netosh kodem shneskala hariv, kodem shneskala hariv atayu echol tot menotsho. So before it becomes a real machlokas, then you can abandon it. Mishneskala hariv atayu echol menotsho. And then the Gemara goes on to say, there is Lakish Omer, Shnayim Shabal Ladin, Echad Rach, the Echad Kasha. So two people will come to have a din with you. One's a tough guy, and one's not so tough, one's more of a pushover. Ad Shul Tishma Divrehen, until you haven't heard what they have to say. Omer Shul Tishma Divrehen, Vieta Yodei Alehem Adin Nota. And you've heard enough, but you don't know yet where things are going. Ata Rashay Lomer Lehem, then you have a right to say to them, Einan Nizkak Lechem, Shem Rizchayev, Chazak, v'nim chazak rodfo. And I'm afraid the strong guy is going to end up guilty and he's going to come kill me, so you have a right to say I'm not getting involved. When you should hear what they have to say and you know where things are going, So here the Gemara says that the dividing line is once you already know where things are going, even before the Gemara did. Now this is slightly different because here the Gemara, which is going to segue, and again we'll talk about this God willing next week, to the Isser of Osaguru Mefarish, which basically is going to say that the Dayan doesn't have a right to say, I'm not dealing with this. So it's different than Pshara in the sense that we've been talking about. Because in this case he's saying, just go out and deal with this yourselves, because I'm not going to deal with it. As opposed to what we've been talking about till now, where the Dayanim are doing the Pshara. So it's not exactly the same situation, but here the Gemara is drawing the line and saying that once you even know where things are tilting, then already too late, you're in. But as far as the Peshawar that we're talking about, if you look in Shulchan Aruch, in Yud Beis Beis, which we've been looking at, so there it says that it draws the line in terms of when you can't offer a Peshawar. That's only by the Gemara Din. But if you haven't yet had the Gemara Din, even though you do know where things are headed, even though you have already a sense where things are going, so then you can and perhaps should offer a pshar. So why is it okay at that point? Or why is it that if you already know where things are going, so then you're allowed to offer a pshar? Why should that make a difference? Yes, sir?
But the Dayanim could still maybe think that that is the best option. I mean, they could say, if we have to go only according to the end, then this person is high. But the better, like, they would want to rule, have a pshara, they just can't necessarily enforce that.
Okay.
So, I don't know if I'm saying myself so well. But the point is, that's the optimal decision, so that
right.
They can still try to pursue that option even after reaching, like, the 50-yada option.
Okay, it's interesting also that if you look at the Sma over there, Sma in Yud Beis, so the Sma vindicates the Svara that we've been saying for the past few days, and then he says that to a certain extent, we do assume that people want Shalom. So that is considered to be something that we do credit them with. Right? The past few days we've been weighing whether or not we should assume people have any motive to make a Pshara, even if they know they could otherwise do better than they did. So here the Sma is validating that idealism by saying that, yes, people want there to be a peaceful resolution. So therefore, if we haven't yet actually reached the stage where we're ready to sign off and say what the din is, so then there's still room to assume a pshara. There's still room to say that this is something that we could talk about. David?
Also, might argue that, like, even if, like, the case is still in one way, who is Perry Mason your way out of it, and maybe get the evidence, and then you go the other way. So it's not necessarily open and shut until it actually is shut.
Okay, so then...
enough lawyer or new evidence. Or
so then, right, so then what do you want to say to that? So you're saying as far as the Bali Din are concerned, so they don't really think it's...
Well, the judges...
So the judges have a general sense of direction, but even their own mind is not really.
Yeah.
Even if they were pretty advanced in the thought, still they don't know how the Baladin are going to react, and there's still room to maybe see it differently. Okay.
I was just saying that it could be that when they do Shara, it could come up a totally different outcome, even though they know what the din is heading, but they don't know necessarily where. If we did Shara, where that would happen.
Okay. So therefore, what?
Therefore. Still be permissible at that point to do a pshara. I don't know if it would be better or help out either party, but it's just an angle. It would still be available.
But does that change things? We know that the pshara could bring a different outcome, and that's what we're saying. There's a limit to how far you can go with that. Right? So maybe we're going to say here that limit should come even at that point when they already know what's happening. Right? So that's what's interesting, that apparently until that point there's enough mixture of factors that you can say that Shalom is still going to be within their interests, even if monetarily available. But once there's already a decision that this is where things are going to go, even if that decision hasn't been spoken out yet, as Tosfos understands it, then already we don't have the right to assume that they want us.
When we saw yesterday, it was yesterday, the day before, with the Rav that the reason for two, according to the Rav, was so that they can have
back and forth.
So maybe they might know where things are heading, but they haven't had a full back and forth yet. There's like not just new evidence, but also new arguments that can always come up and new avenues of the ways of looking at it. So even if you do know which way it's going for yourself, that doesn't mean that somebody might not suggest a different viewpoint.
Right. So what we're clearing here is two points. One, there's a difference between that and the immediate pre-Gemara period. Right. And also that since there is that difference and there's still some flexibility, so now the assumption is that the two parties want Pshara, explains the Sma, not just because maybe it's a bet that they'll do better, but separate from that, that they're interested in Shalom. So this is just a point they want to focus on, that we do credit them with an interest in Shalom beyond their monetary benefits. But once the benefits are set, that this one's going to win, this one's going to lose, then already we're worried that you might be misleading them, which is interesting. Now, you recall, yesterday we mentioned the Shulta Giborim, that the Shulta Giborim says, the Shaf quotes, that even after the Gemara Din, you're not allowed to impose the Pshara, but you can still try to talk to them. And you can try to say, listen, this is over, but you guys have been friends for so long, and you don't want to have this between you, and it really is a little bit fair to go this way instead of that way.
This is after Gemara Din?
Right.
It's still coercing them, just not physically.
Oh, well, that's the question. Is it called coercing them? Because the Shach is emphasizing, the Shach's point of Shulta Gibarim, is emphasizing that it's not coercive. Right? Basically saying that, listen, Reuben won, Shimon lost. But listen, Reuben and Shimon, I just want you to know that it's going to be hard for you guys to keep playing golf every week as you've been doing under these circumstances. And, you know, Reuben, people are going to be a little hesitant to do business with you because you're such a captain and you insist on your rights. And, you know, it was a little bit Reuven's fault, and can you really say that Shimon shouldn't get anything? So what do you guys think? Is it worth it to take a different attitude? So says the Shulta Kibarim, we can still do that, even after the Gemara Din. Now it's interesting to note that the Bach disagrees. The Bach thinks, no, that even that you can't do after Gemara Din. And the later Sfarim say, what? Come on, you should always be able to do that. That's basic peacemaking. And how could you ever say you can't do that? And that's the minhag. That's what the later Sfarim write. The minhag is they still might take such a advisory attitude even after the Gemara Din. So as we noted yesterday, that it's interesting because to say, all right, this you can do because, as opposed to what Sammy's saying, this is voluntary. Right? You're not going to actually compel. But the whole thing is voluntary anyway. The whole agreement to engage in Pshara is voluntary. So what's the difference between this voluntary and that voluntary? So this works with what we explained yesterday, that it's two different types of voluntary. That when you're dealing with the Beis Din as the ones imposing the Pshara, you are voluntarily committing to their das. That whatever the Dayanim think is a good Pshara, I commit to dealing with that. I commit to allowing that to be my guiding post. But here we're saying, okay, so now the Dayanim are no longer going to tell you this is what you have to do, even as a Pshara. But to try to convince you of the merits, so that you should be able to do. That should be fine. Okay. So, it's interesting also that the distinction between after the Gemara Din and before the Gemara Din is another explanation that was suggested by the Shaul HaMeshiv. Shaul HaMeshiv was Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson of Lvov, who was a tremendous posek. He wrote thousands of tshuvas. If you open up his farm, they're very intimidating because they're all in the small print, and he has pages upon pages and pages. He wrote thousands of tshuvas. And each one of his volumes, he starts all over again, the Dalet Chavkei Shulchan Aruch, so the new Madura, a second Madura, a third Madura, so in the sixth Madura, the Siman Yud Dalet, the Tshuva Shaul HaMeshiv, He has a tshuva about this, where he quotes a very different svara as to why it is that you can't make a pshara after the Gemara Din. And he suggests that maybe we have to worry about the following. That maybe when Shmuley and Josh have this Din Torah, and Shmuley Al-Pidin should win, and Josh Al-Pidin should lose, and we've already established that. Right? So we already discussed yesterday that in our hypothetical, so Josh borrowed money from me in my Arif case. Okay? So actually I'll have to switch. Let's say Shmuley borrowed money from me in my Arif case yesterday. So maybe he still owes me the money. Right? But he's saying he doesn't have any money. So now he's going to win some money. So he should pay me. So maybe once the Gemar Din is in effect, then really that money is essentially my money, the third party's money. And if you're going to make a pshara at that point and say, you know what, Shmuley give some of it back to Josh, I'm going to lose out. But until that's actually been clarified in Beis Din, it could be it's not Shmuley's money in the first place. And then it's viable to say that pshara is something we can consider. But once there has actually been some reality to the din, so then maybe there are other affected parties and maybe it's not fair to start talking about pshara. Which is fascinating because it's a whole different perspective on what the issue is. But that may also bring other things into consideration. Right? That once you have a pshara, so a pshara is great when it's addressing the two people in front of you, but what if there are other people who are involved? So if those other people could end up paying a price too, so do you have the same flexibility when deciding between din and pshara? Right? You might recall we talked about what the Shura said din the other day. So we raised the question of whether, let's say, a institution that's covered by a charity that's supported by communal funds, so does an institution have the right to go with the Mishra Sadin? And ultimately we noted that Toshkim all seem to take the position that yes, public institutions can and should go with the Mishra Sadin. But the premise of the question was that maybe if you have other people's money involved, it's not right to go with the Mishra Sadin. So here also, maybe there's what to wonder once there's a potential third party who could be affected, which is interesting. Hi.
Can you, the svara of the Shlomo Meshev is that there's like this new reality that's made through din?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the point? And what does that have to do with money being in a third party or second party?
Because let's say there's another person who has a claim on Shmuley's money. Right? Or let's say, to make it more specific, right, let's say we're talking about property that Shmuley and Josh are fighting over. Right? Property sometimes is meshubit to a balko, right, can sometimes be considered to be under a lien that somebody who's a creditor has the right to take it. So now we'll say, well, fine, this house, if it really belongs to Shmuley, I can collect from it. But actually, Shmuley and Josh have been in the din Torah about whether the house really is his in the first place. Right, so if it's not really clarified al pidin whose it is, then maybe okay we could talk about a pshara. But once it's been clarified that it's actually Shmuley's, and the Bezin wants to step in and say, but you know what, maybe there's a reason to give a percentage of it to Josh, maybe I'll step in and say, wait a minute, but I'm going to go seize that house because of the debts that Shmuley has to me. So you're taking it out of my pocket. So once other people get involved, gets a little more complicated.
I guess my question is then, why have to have liens and why deal with that in the svara? Why don't you just say it now belongs to Shmuel? It's now his.
Mm-hmm.
So to have pshara after it already has become the reality of his, and the judges have to now invoke, let's say, hefker based on hefker or something like that. Pshara might not work. Maybe.
So you're saying without the Shulta Gibar, right? You're saying that, let's assume that we're talking about an imposed pshara, right? Not that the... Can we clear, if the issue is just like you're saying, that Shmuley owns it and we're taking it away from him,
right.
So he doesn't have to agree. So then we wouldn't really have a question based on his ownership.
Right.
But you're saying that, let's talk about when they impose the pshara, that maybe they're going to impose it against his will, and then essentially you're taking it away from him.
Right.
You have to figure out whether that totally lines up, because to a certain extent, that's also a part of this process, that the person who is involved in Shara is acknowledging a correctness in giving up the property to the other. It's just that when there's another party involved, it gets a little more complicated. The Nesiv has a fascinating comment here. Take a look at the Nesiv in the Marom Nesodah over here. So the Nesiv asks, right, you see in our Gemara that there is a contrast between two attitudes. That the attitude of Pshara is associated with Aaron HaKohen. Right, Aaron was the one who always took this attitude of trying to settle things. And who had a different approach? Moshe, Yikov HaDin HaSahar. So if we're saying ultimately that there is a proper value to Pshara, so why didn't Moshe do it? Why was Moshe not so involved in Pshara, if that's really the way to go? So the Nesiv suggests, in a fascinating way, that Moshe was very quick. Right, Moshe knew all the dinim very solidly. He was the one who taught everyone else all the dinim. So the Torah process, despite Yisrael's concern that he's going to plot to deal with everybody's Din Torah, but I guess each specific Din Torah was very quick because he knew right away where things were going. So essentially, Moshe Rabbeinu was already at this point when it's not appropriate to make up Shara very quickly in each dispute that he got involved with, so then he didn't want to make up Shara at that point. And then the Nesiv makes a distinction that even if you want to say, let's say like Rashi, that but if he hasn't said it out loud, if he hasn't said, okay, you're guilty, you're innocent, then still, no matter how quickly he came to the conclusion, there should still be a space there. So he wants to suggest the distinction that even if it's mutter before you've said it, it's not really a mitzvah at that point. The idea of mitzvah is when you really don't know yet what the conclusion is. Then you could say it's a mitzvah. If you're basically at the conclusion, so Tosfos will say you're not allowed to make up Shara, and Rashi might say you are allowed to, but even according to Rashi, it's still not necessarily a mitzvah, it's just a possibility. So there wasn't any advantage to doing that, so Moshe didn't do it, because Moshe was essentially always, at least at that point, where he basically knew where things were going. Okay, it's an interesting point. Meshuvas Cheshev HaEifod. The Cheshev HaEifod was written by Padua, who's a Dayan in London, actually. Right? Heard that name? So I think his son is still in London. But not so long ago, the Cheshev HaEifod has a tshuva where he says that the situation that we're talking about now, where essentially a situation could turn into Pshara in the middle, that you could have a situation which starts off in Din, and that's what our Gemara is describing here, that there's a certain point where you can no longer have a Pshara, but until then, theoretically, something could convert to Pshara in the middle. So maybe more often a Pshara situation is people come to the Dayan and they say, we want to talk about Pshara. But we see from here, there's a scenario where they came saying, we want to talk about Din. And in the middle of the Din, if it's not yet the Gemara Din, so they said they want to talk about Pshara. So says the Cheshev HaEifod, in that situation, you know what? You can follow Rov. Then if you have three Dayanim, and two of them say one way, and one says another way, as far as how the Pshara should play out, you can follow Rov. Even though we've been talking before about Tosfos' view, which most of the Rishonim seem to agree with, parenthetically. Although Shulchan Aruch does quote it as a machlokas, but most of the Rishonim that we know about seem to agree with. Now, we don't follow Rov for Pshara, and we gave all these explanations why. So here he says it'll be different. Why should it be different? What's the difference in this situation? Why should we follow a Rove in that case? You want to try to guess what his logic is? Yes, sir?
Not just simply because it started off as Din, so you already have three, and because it wouldn't have been necessary if you had done Pshara in the first place, and therefore...
You mean because Pshara could have done with less than three?
Right. So
well, even let's say working off the assumption that Pshara does need three, I think his logic still doesn't apply. Sammy?
I think similarly, the parties came in with thinking that it was going to be done, and, like, it's going to be done in a different type of way, so they already would be accepting of principles of based in such as Rove.
Oh.
So just apply those to another scenario would be okay.
Right, that's basically what he wrote. Right, he's saying that essentially when they come to a Bez of Pshara, then they're expecting that they're going to have a unanimous conclusion. But when they started off with Din, so the whole understanding was already that they're working within the system where Rove decides where they could have a 2-to-1 vote. So if the Dayanim say in the middle, listen, we just want you to know that as we think about this, we want to use the tools of Pshara rather than absolute Din, what do you say? And they say, okay, so then that's also going to be subject to Rove. Now, you may recall that we discussed a number of explanations as to why we don't have Rove by Pshara, so this isn't going to work for all of them. Right? It was just a second suggestion that it's an issue of the if the Bali didn't agree to it. Ultimately, if Soloveitchik, for example, didn't like that explanation, and he said that inherently the mechanism of Pshara doesn't work with Rove. But here he's saying that if you have agreement from the parties, which is implicit in the fact that they all came under the premise of Din, so then Rove works. So from what we've seen, it really depends on how you explain what the issue is with Rove. Now the Meiri has a very interesting comment over here. And the Meiri suggests, and this is maybe a little bit of a key to understand a lot of other things, that at this point, at the after the Gemara Din, where you can't really talk Pshara anymore, so there's still a role to play towards peace, and that is to try to get the parties to prepare themselves to perceive the justice in the din, and the shalom in the din. And he focuses on the fact, for example, that let's say I'm going to say, okay, that Yoni has to give up his bottle of soda to Zach, and that's going to be a little bit of a difficult moment for him. But he should be happy too, because he wouldn't want in Shemayim to know that he has Zach's soda. So the Dayanim are helping him out by giving him the opportunity to set things straight. So that's an interesting idea. Chazal have that idea, right? That you should be grateful when you lose an Adin Torah because you've been saved from Vosigzal. So you start trying to convey that attitude to them, that you should know that this is really good for both of you. So that's a particularly interesting comment, because it kind of suggests the spectrum that Din and Pshara are on. I think it's very useful as kind of a perspective on this whole issue, that it highlights the fact that Din and Pshara, even if the conclusions could be very different, right, and the conclusions could be different in a polar way, right, Din might say that Reuven wins 100% and Shimon wins 0, while Pshara might be 50-50, or it might even be 100% the other direction. Right, so practically speaking, the conclusions of Din and Pshara could look very different from each other. But in concept, they are not opposed to each other, but rather they're on a spectrum. That Din represent principles of Shalom in the abstract. And real life gets a little bit more complicated. So Pshara allows you to consider the factors of real life that maybe would push things in a different direction. But at the core, they're the same thing. Din is the shalom of the abstract, which is truth, right? So in a perfect world, Din would always be perceived as shalom. And Pshara is the din as functioning in the real world,
where we may have to consider some other elements in order to have it perfectly match with Shalom. So I think that's an important principle just for us to kind of close with another sukkah, even though we have a few more minutes to say about it. But also just to keep in mind, because it ties into so many other things, that essentially what we're talking about here when we talk about the finisher is the din, and we talk about shara. So we're not talking about erasing the din, or about ignoring the din. We're talking about finding the way that the din is most genuinely upheld. So l'fnim mishuras hadin means that there are some circumstances where the letter of the law is getting in the way of the spirit, or we should say rather, of not allowing the spirit to be fully expressed. So then in those cases we pay close attention to the spirit of the law and we act l'fnim mishuras hadin as individuals. Or we take a different conclusion within our disputes when dealing with parties in conflict with each other. I think this is an idea that you find in a number of places. For example, in the concept of Kiddush Hashem, I have this idea. Kiddush Hashem, which always sounds like a very beautiful idea, and of course it is, but we have to understand what it means. And sometimes you find the din changes mishum Kiddush Hashem. Right, let's say you have sometimes halachos where you're not sure if you have to return something to someone else. And we say that mishum kiddush Hashem you do have to return. So what do those words mean? Right, does that mean that, well, the din is one way, but people won't be too impressed with that. So since you should impress people, so change the din. Right, give them the kind of din that they will like. That's not such a nice idea, really, right? Doesn't it make it sound like, well, we'll just change the way we let people know about the halacha so that we can do whatever we need to win them over. Right? That's not such a great statement about our halachic system. So I think what it means when we talk about Kiddush Hashem is that the halacha is based on certain principles. And those principles are our principles. But sometimes circumstances could have so many nuances and so many details that somebody who doesn't fully appreciate the whole system will look at that example and they'll say, oh, the principle isn't even there. Oh, these Jews, they don't believe in returning lost property. They don't believe in not stealing. And of course, the truth is the opposite. We invented the idea of not stealing and returning lost property. But in this circumstance, the details are, for whatever reason, going to point in a different direction. But if those details are going to create a situation where the core principle is going to be misunderstood, and people will say, oh, the Jews don't believe in the values which actually we do believe in, so then Kiddush Hashem is telling you then you should focus on the value and let that dictate things rather than the details. So that's the concept that we find throughout. So what Kiddush Hashem is about, and what L'fnim Mishuras Hadin is about, and what Pshara is about, that we have these core values, then we have details, and ideally we'll have the values and the details all point in the same direction. But sometimes when they don't, then we have to prioritize the value, and that's how we make our decisions in terms of Kiddush Hashem, in terms of L'fnim Mishuras Hadin, and therefore in terms of Pshara, which is the embodiment of L'fnim Mishuras Hadin. Okay, so just to say one more point, and then this really will be our Gemara Din on Pshara. So, you may recall that we started this sugya by contrasting it with Daf Lamed Beis in Sanhedrin, where Gemara invokes Pshara as well, but in a different context. That there the Gemara talks about what's Pshara. Pshara is, let's say you have two boats about to crash into each other in the river. So you decide who goes first. You say one of them is more loaded down, one is less loaded down, one is closer to the destination, one is farther than the destination, and you make the heavier loaded boat or the one that's farther, you let them go first. So we noted there that that's different than our pshara in one sense, that our pshara and davav has been talking about a situation where there is din to apply, and yet we might still prefer pshara.
while the Gemara in Sanhedrin, and later in Sanhedrin, rather, Lamed Beis, is talking about a situation where there is no din. There is no way to adjudicate the situation al pi din. So then that's a more clearly necessary kind of pshara. So despite that distinction, first of all, we should note that they're all still based on Be'ezis HaYel Sheva HaTov. So the value that pushes us towards pshara is still very significant in both forms. But clearly there are differences. So the Tumim notes, based on the Sma, that in that situation where there is no din, so then you can be kofir. So then the Bezdin can impose pshara. Because until now, we're talking about pshara has to be voluntarily accepted by the Balei Din. But if there's no option of din, so then the Beis Din can compel. Then the Beis Din can order the parties to accept this kind of a pshara. It doesn't have to necessarily be purely voluntary. And the Tumim discusses that, and this is in light of the fact that, again, we mentioned before that our Gemara kind of segues into the question of whether a Dayan has the equal right to recommend din or pshara, and to the topic of whether the Dayan has a right to pull out completely. Does the Dayan have a right to say, I'm afraid you guys, I'm not getting involved? So the Tumim discusses, so let's say you have two parties and you've already spoken to them, and you realize that there's somebody lying here, that there's some degree of sheker. So you're not going to be able to clarify the facts to the point where you can impose the din properly. So because you can't just leave them hanging, you can't just pull out at that point, so then essentially your only choice is a pshara, and you have the right to compel it. In those circumstances, you can compel a pshara. He makes a distinction. He says that if you, let's say you have a tovei and a nitva, you have somebody who comes to you and says, I think that guy owes me money. And the guy who is being accused, you suspect that he's lying. Right? So essentially, you can't drop the case and you can't really apply it perfectly because you don't have all the honest facts. So then that's the kind of situation where you can impose a pshara. If you think the tovei is lying, if the guy comes to you and says, I think somebody else owes me money, and you think that guy is lying, then you could say, all right, listen, I don't want to deal with you because I think your whole case is sketchy. And you could pull out. It's just interesting that this is the opposite of a story I once heard. My cousin told me a story once where I think it was Rukhain, that there was a man who got into a monetary dispute with a non-Jewish neighbor of his, or a non-Jewish partner. And he convinced this person, even though he wasn't Jewish, that they should have the Rav decide the story. And he went to, I think it was Rukhain, who was the local Rav, and said, could you adjudicate this case between us? And then, right before, the Jewish man says to Rukhain, says in Yiddish, says, the Rabbi machnit in the pshara. You should make a pshara between us. So right away, Rukhain said to him in Yiddish, Alagel dafin tish yetz. He said, put all the money on the table now. Meaning, what happened? That he realized that this guy was trying to cheat the non-Jewish man. That he figured that, okay, if we can get him into the Jewish court, then he'll be on his turf, and he'll be able to get the Rav to paskin in his favor. So when he said to the Rav, make a pshara with him, the Rav realized, the Chaim realized, that essentially this guy didn't really have the facts on his side. He realized that he didn't really have justice with him. So he's saying, yeah, you know, let's be friends here and make a deal between him because otherwise he's going to win. So when Chaim realized that this guy was trying to take advantage of a non-Jewish man, said, nothing doing, now I'm treating you al pi din, and put all the money on the table, and presumably the other guy's going to win. So it's kind of the reverse of the story, that here what the Tumim is saying is that when you suspect someone's lying and you can't deal with it, so therefore impose pshara. And here, this is kind of the reverse story, that they came because he asked for pshara, he realized that he was lying, and therefore he imposed ikar hadin on him and took away the pshara. But I guess the situation could more commonly come the other way, that somebody lying is going to make the facts so complicated, which is what you find in other svarim also, that if the situation is so complex that essentially you cannot get to the depth of the din, so then you're going to need pshara. And essentially, the netziv, in the tshuva, so he reads this into the Gemara on Daf Lamed Beis. So the Gemara is saying, oh, what's pshara? Right? Just if you remember the language of the Gemara, that's the Gemara's language, Lamed Beis, Lamed Beis, Tzedek Tzedek Tirdof, Echad Adin, Be'echad Pshara, Ketza, how do you have it? Shtei Sfinus Ovros Benar, Repagu Zebazem, Ovros Shtei and Shtei and Tovos Bazach, Hazash, Shtei and Ovros, etc., etc. So why do we need this example of Pshara? Says the Netziv, what's going on here is the Gemara is asking, okay, so you have a mitzvah of Tzedek, Tzedek Tirdof, and a mitzvah of Pshara, so it sounds like you can basically force someone into Pshara. How could you do that? Or do you have a situation where you could force someone into Pshara? So you have a situation like this with the two boats. You have two boats. There's no real din way to decide who goes first. But what happens if you don't make some decision? So they'll crash into each other and they'll both drown, or the stronger one will plow through the weaker one and the weaker one will drown. So clearly that's not going to be acceptable. So a situation like that, what the Gemara is telling you is that you have to force them to say that even though I'll be din, I can't force one boat to let the other boat go first. But I'll be pshara, I have to. And therefore, the Gemara is essentially telling you that you can compel a pshara in that case. And similarly, the Rabbaz writes in the Tshuva that if the Dayanim themselves don't feel they have an answer, if they have a suffix, they've listened to everything and they simply can't resolve it, and again, to connect our Gemaras here, so they added on Dayanim and they've added everybody and there's just no resolution here. Everybody's gotten on board and nobody's able to cut through this whole story. So then all of that is a situation in which Pshara is the only viable plan, and therefore Pshara can be compelled. Okay, so I think that will take us into the sugya of Mechila and Kinyan, which we'll pick up with next week after our different programs for the next few days. Let's just quickly review what we spoke about today. So we spoke about this din, that when there's a Gemara din, you can't have a suggestion of Pshara anymore. Rashi and Rambam say that it means you've already issued the ruling. Tosfos says that it means that you already know where it's going to go, and therefore you're basically deceiving them. And the question is, how do you deal with Tosfos and Bava Kamma and Tosfos and Bava Metzia, which talk about dividing between when they say you're chayiv and you're zakai, and when they actually say go out and give it. That seems to actually be the Gemara din. And here, Tosfos over there kind of tilts things a little bit differently and says that even at that stage, the Bali din might still think things could change, and therefore it's only an issue of possibly deceiving them. And the Adorama has that comment that in Bava Metzia we're interested in what the Bali din think is final, and in Sanhedrin we're interested in what the Dayanim think is final. And then we talked also about the Shulta Kibarim and the Shach, that you still can try to convince them that it's a good idea to go for the details of a pshara after the Gemara din, even though the Bach surprisingly disagrees, but the Gemara din is against them. And we mentioned again the Ashur Shlomo, who explains the distinction that the Dayanim can't compel their das at that point, but they can still go on the facts and say why the facts are preferable. And we talked about why, even though the back and forth in the Gemara about this, that yes, you can't do pshara after the Gemara din, but you can do it after you already know where things are going. And the Sma says, because ultimately we do credit the parties with wanting to make shalom, and therefore that's significant. You mentioned the Shiva Shalom Meshiv. It says that the issue after Gemara Din is that maybe the person who would have won, maybe he has a shiva to somebody else, and that person is going to lose out. And we mentioned the Merome Sada, the Netziv, that maybe the reason Moshe Rabbeinu didn't do Pshara is because he knew right away where things were going, and even if you want to follow Rashi, that he didn't say it out loud yet, so why should that still stop him from doing Pshara? That maybe at that point, even if it's permissible, but it's not a mitzvah to do Pshara. And we talked about this situation where a Bezdin could convert in the middle to Pshara, so the Cheshav Eifel Rotz writes in that case that we would follow Rov, even though normally we don't follow Rov in cases of Pshara, And we noted that only works if you understand the issue with Rove, is that the Bali Din are only accepting it when it's unanimous, but here if they come for Din, maybe that means it should be a different story. And then we talked about the Meiri, that at this stage you try to explain to them the justice that's within the Pesach, and how even the loser should be happy to lose because it's better for his neshama and the like. So we then use that to explain how Din and Shara are not opposite points of the spectrum. They are not opposed to each other. They're really just different points along the same range, and that Din is about Shalom, but in real life, Shalom might require extra attention to some details. So that's what Shara is doing for us. And we compared that to Kiddush Hashem. Kiddush Hashem also is about recognizing where the values lie and sometimes emphasizing that over the details. And that's what Shara and the Mishur Sadin are also telling us to do. And then we just noted that when the Gemara on the base talks about Shara, so we established at the beginning that that's a different kind of Shara. It's a Shara when there is no possibility of going based on Din. And in that case, it seems then Kfiya is an option, that you can force the Bali Din to go along with your Shara. We mentioned the Tumim, who says that if it's a suspicion of Ramos, you may have to go for Shara instead of Din, and then you can impose that. We mentioned the how that's the opposite of the Chaim story, where he realized Ramos because the litigant was trying to invoke Shara, so then he dafka imposed Din. And we talked about the Nitziv and his Tshuva, how he sees from this Gemara Lami Beis that it's basically talking about compelling Shara, because that's the whole finish of that Gemara, that in a situation like this, where if you don't find some way to resolve it, people are going to drown. So then clearly you have to compel Shara, and that's how the whole process works. And I mentioned the Rabbaz, who says that if the Dayanim themselves are in the Sufik about what's going on, so then Shara is the only avenue, and once again that can be compelled. Okay, we will stop here, and the question is going to be, who's going to daven and cook for us? Sammy, you look like you're putting away your computer in the room.